when they were doing sit-ins. She held civil rights meetings at her home. And today to come out and not be able to vote and no one can give you an explanation, like, it's extremely emotional and it bothers me.
U.S. citizens are going to the polls on November 3rd to exercise their right to vote for president, senators, congressional representatives, and other elected officials. Will this election be business as usual?
To see if you can track your vote, type the name of your state and track a vote into your web browser.
By November 2nd, more than 59 million mail-in votes have been cast. Will they be counted?
We want to make sure that we elect a person who will strengthen labor, progress labor, and make sure that we can continue to take care of our families.
And we'll learn how organized labor is preparing for Election Day and beyond. This and much more from Pacifica Radio. This is COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Akua Holt. Will voters choose the president or the purge?
We're not going to let them steal this election. I mean, we're going to stand up for what's right here, but they ain't going to steal it from these people. Look at all these Americans here.
He's upholding the voters' law of America. Either your signature matches or it doesn't. If it doesn't, you don't get to vote. You have to come back in and redo the thing.
And I think if they throw rocks, we should kill them.
That's what Trump said.
See?
And it's just, it's horrible. And I say that because the West End, she's been in this community back when we could, when they were doing sit-ins. She held civil rights meetings in her home. And today to come out and not be able to vote and no one can give you an explanation, like, it's extremely emotional and it bothers me.
Breaking news, this is a big political story. Thousands of Wisconsin voters will be removed from the state's voter registry following the ruling of an Ozaukee County judge.
And I don't know why it is that we have people who are so adamant about making sure that we take people off the registration roll.
In 2016, Donald Trump was elected president by just 77,000 votes, about the size of a Beyonce concert. But over 2 million voters showed up at the polls and were told their registrations had been eliminated, vanished.
How can we come to this point where there's no love at all for a whole group of people who are not going to understand when they go to vote why they're getting hassled?
Wisconsin's Republican legislature had voted to eliminate 129,000 voters, six times Trump's teeny 2016 victory margin. The state said they moved. They left the state. This is Sequana Taylor.
Found out last week that I was on the purge list.
Okay, so what are your positions here?
Yep, so Milwaukee County Supervisor, District 2, and School Board Director, District 3.
It comes down to a simple question. Did these voters actually move? This is John Lenzer.
Well, we've worked for everybody from Home Depot to Amazon. I've worked for 300 to 400 different companies. They use advanced address hygiene to correct their databases and make sure they have the correct address of their customers so that their mailings are more accurate. We use 240 different data feeds from all kinds of companies. Subscriptions to magazines, your mortgage address, pretty much anything you subscribe to. And they maintain a file of a person's correct address. I would think that whether it be the state of Wisconsin or the state of Georgia or other states that have used these techniques would be well advised to use advanced address hygiene. They'd save a lot of money and have a more accurate result.
They know where I'm at. They know where to find me. It's not hard.
But those directing the purge don't even look at the state's records.
I never left the state, I never left the county. So all they had to do was look at my DMV record and they would see that I live in the same county.
And not just any voters get purged. The hit list targeted 1 in 7 of the state's Black, Hispanic, and Asian American voters.
You could call this Purgeville.
And the purge list was also filled with young voters.
Hello, my name is Pio. I'm 21 years of age. I currently go to Madison College. Because I moved two houses down from where I used to live, I was removed from the voter rolls, and that's just not fair.
False stories, all made up, lies.
And voter fraud is all too common.
So do you believe that there's fraud in Michigan?
Well, we've been very aggressive in closing vulnerabilities and loopholes.
Well, I see the aggression.
It was a shock when Trump won Michigan, and by a mere 10,700 votes. But the state had purged at least 60,000 voters based on a secret list.
499,092 Michiganders are on this suspect list. Mm-hmm. Is this to eliminate fraud or is this to eliminate voters?
It's to clean our voter lists and ensure that there's no vulnerability for fraud.
Statistical experts who have looked at this list say it's heavily overweighted against minorities because it's just basically a list of common names.
I'm not familiar
Michael
with that.
Brown, Jose Garcia. Mm-hmm. Could you imagine that would be a problem in terms of...
I did not know Brown was identified with one race.
You know, Brown was a common name in America, and
it's a
black
very
name.
Common name.
It's a very common black name in America, yes.
I've known a lot of white Browns.
So it's like you were disappeared, like you were not even a person.
That's what I said. I was dead and gone and buried. But I'm still on top of the earth at the hip of the nester.
Since I was about 5, I've been going with her to vote. Every year, like religiously.
If you have been purged from the rolls, you can still register on Election Day in Wisconsin, Michigan, Nevada, and more. Thanks to Consortium News, Greg Palace, Deborah Messing, Black Voters Matters, and Entertainment Weekly. Why was voter suppression necessary? Political analyst and retired attorney Mr. C talks to KPFT's Dr. Obidike Kamau about the history and impact of voter suppression in the South.
Mr. C, when did voting become important to you?
Voting became extremely important even when I was a little child back in the 50s. People had to pay poll tax. My father, my grandfather, all my relatives always paid the poll tax. They paid it with a frown on their face. They realized that the reason it was there, it was to prevent us from voting. I remember my grandfather and all my elderly relatives saying voting is important because the people who hate us don't want us to vote. And it makes them mad when we vote. If someone doesn't want you to have something and it makes them angry for you to have it and exercise it, there must be a reason that they're making it as difficult as possible. If the enemy doesn't want me to do something, that's exactly what I'm going to do.
I want to extend this conversation on voter suppression. You talked about poll tax. I remember my father paying poll tax. Poll tax is an earlier form of voter suppression. The quick history of voter suppression, as far as we know, goes back to the South after the Civil War, during the era of Reconstruction, when they began to come up with ways to prevent our ancestors from voting. How has voting suppression evolved from the days of literacy tests and poll taxes to now?
Well, it's very important for us to understand our right to vote has always been in jeopardy. I actually have a copy of the Louisiana literacy test, which zero black folks. Now, mind you, I had relatives in Louisiana that had doctor's degrees. Zero black folks were able to pass it. White people who couldn't read and write always were able to pass it. Some of these tests involve, explain to me the 13th Amendment of the Constitution to my satisfaction. Mm-hmm. Well, obvious. All a person has to do is look at you. Nope, you didn't explain to my satisfaction, so you're not intelligent enough to vote. And we have to understand these weren't ever tests. How many bubbles in a bottle of soap? How many jelly beans are in this jar? These weren't tests. These were obstacles that were set up specifically to take away our right to vote. So for us to even discuss these things is an exercise in futility because there was no merit to them. There was no logic to it. It was strictly set up to prevent us from voting. However, the courts ruled and struck down all these things. They had to get pre-clearance from the federal government if they were going to make certain changes as if they're going to pass certain laws that affected our particular right to vote. Shelby County v. Holder, which was a 5-4 decision in 2013, the Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act that was passed in 1965, which allowed us some protection. The Supreme Court, in this 5-4 decision, the 5 Republicans against the 4 Democrats, ruled that all that stuff that the South was doing way back then, that doesn't exist anymore. There's a fairness now. Now, I'm saying that facetiously, obviously. There's a fairness now. It's not like that anymore. We're dealing with a different set of politicians for the states, you know, Texas, Louisiana, Alabama, Mississippi, Tennessee, Georgia, Kentucky, South Carolina. The states that were suppressing Black people's rights to vote, they don't do that anymore. Everything's fair. We're dealing with a level playing field. And so we're going to gut the Voting Rights Act. What did these states do as soon as they gutted it? Went right back to moving the goalposts and went right back to the same dirty tactics they were doing before the Voting Rights Act was passed in 1965.
If there is no method to prevent them from acting on their dark desires, we can be assured that they will act on them. And as soon as the Voting Rights Bill was gutted in 2013, they began actively voter suppressing again.
No doubt about it. I can go to specific things that have occurred right here in our great state of Texas. If you can recall, let's just go back 2010 before they gutted it. You didn't see people standing in line for 6 hours, 8 hours. You didn't see that, but you see it now. You don't see it occurring where people of Caucasian descent live. You see it in the African-American communities. In the state of Texas, there were 700 polling places closed. They were primarily closed in Black and Hispanic communities. At one time, there was one polling place for every 4,000. Now there's one polling place for every 7,000 to 8,000. In other words, they've been packed in. This is specifically designed, these long lines, this long waiting, is specifically designed for people to drive up and say, wait a minute, man, I'm not going to sit in no line in this hot sun or in this pouring rain for no 5 hours to vote. I'm going back home. It is an effective form of voter suppression. Let me give you this example. A friend of mine in McLennan County, deputy clerk. McLennan County is where Waco is located. McLennan County had 59 polling places. They're down to 23, which means they closed 26 polling places. McLennan County has increased in population by 15,000 people. The 23 polling places that were closed in Black neighborhoods, in Hispanic neighborhoods. They didn't close them in white neighborhoods. They didn't close them in the Republican. In the state of Texas, Texas closed 542 polling sites, and the majority of them were closed in the most populated Black and Latino counties. These areas where they've closed 542 polling sites, places, have gained 2.5 million people in population. The clerk says, this is a bunch of bull manure. Well, we're attempting to save money, and we're attempting to make voting more efficient. And we're attempting, I mean, I can go on and on with the bull malarkey that they've come as to their reasoning and their rationale. We're not trying to, we're not discriminating against Black people and Hispanic people. We want all votes to count. I'm the kind of person who will look them straight in the face and say, liar, liar, pants on fire.
That was political analyst and retired attorney, Mr. C, speaking to KPFT's Dr. Obidike Kamau. By October 31st, more than 57 million mail-in votes have been cast. Most states offer a way to let you track your ballot online to confirm it's been received before your state's deadline. Some will also let you track whether or not it has been accepted and will be counted. Pacifica's Ann Garrison reports.
In the state of California, once you've signed up to track your ballot on your County Registrar of Voters website, you can also receive text or email notifications that your ballot has been received, accepted, and will be counted, or that it has been received but not accepted for whatever reason. According to the Secretary of State's office, Any protest that a ballot should have been counted but was not will be considered on a case-by-case basis. One track-a-vote system or another is available in most states, but systems vary widely across the country. Here's election integrity expert Harvey Wasserman.
Well, like the election itself, it varies from county to county and state to state. And there are different systems in different counties and different states. There are some that are run by the actual government. The Postal Service actually runs vote tracking, although they won't tell you if your vote has been counted, only if it's been received or delivered. But some postal outlets will give you pretty detailed information on how long it takes to get there and stuff like that. The county election boards, some will tell you if your vote has been counted, some won't. Some will actually call you if you made a mistake on your ballot and ask you to come in, and the extant word is cure your ballot. In other words, correct the shortcomings. Of course, the Trump administration hates that. But there are all sorts of different ways to track your ballot. You have to find out if it's been counted only by the election board, and some of them won't tell you. Others will. I mean, there's no federal law on this. So it's really up to the discretion of the state and the county and the election board.
It seems that Wyoming and Mississippi both require that the voter go into the registrar voter's office.
It just depends. You know, like you say, Wisconsin is a different system from Texas, which is different from California and New Jersey. I mean, they're just all over the map. That's just the way it is. It's the same as we're going to find out, on election night and the 2 weeks after or more, where Trump tries to get the election into the Supreme Court. That's the game that's going to be played. It's all these different systems that we have, state by state and county by county, are going to go up to the Supreme Court, and Donald Trump is intending to win the presidency by a vote count of 6-3 or 5-4.
Does track-a-vote have any potential if it were uniformly available all over the country, everyone knew about it, a lot of people used it, would it have the potential to help assure an honest election?
Yeah, it does help. The more you know, the better it is.
That was election integrity expert Harvey Wasserman on track-a-vote systems across the U.S. To see if you can track your vote, type the name of your state and track-a-vote into your web browser. For Pacifica, I'm Ann Garrison.
The Republican Party is facing a serious dilemma about its appeal or lack thereof to voters of color. We now hear from retired Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, who served as Chief of Staff to former Secretary of State Colin Powell, in conversation with Paul Jay on his podcast, The Analysis.
When Colin Powell told the RNC many years ago, if you don't open your tent, if you don't allow blacks, Hispanics, if you don't allow all sexual orientations and so forth to come into your tent, you are damned. You will never win again unless you use illegal methods, cheating, whatever, gerrymandering and so forth. Well, look at what we've seen the Republican Party do. They've used every manner, form, and shape of illegal and semi-legal activity in order to hold on to power. Look at North Carolina, if you want a really intense look at that. Look at Ohio, too, for different reasons. But the Republicans know they're damned. They can't win another election in this country. That's the reason you have people like Mike Lee saying democracy is not necessarily the best form of government. Well, no, for people like Mike and like others in the Republican Party, it isn't. Because democracy, they define it as mob rule. And they quote Jefferson and mob rule, mob rule. What they mean in essence is these black people and these brown people and these new demographics coming up are never going to cast a Republican vote, or it's going to be a rarity when they do. And look at the numbers of them. Look at New York. Look at Los Angeles. Look at Chicago. Hell, look at Houston. Why did Governor Abbott declare there could only be one drop box in Harris County with 4.5 million people? Can you imagine 4.5 million people trying to get to one drop box? Well, because they're mostly Democrats. That's the way the Republicans hold on to power. And they know that's the only way they can hold on to power. So you're going to see more and more shenanigans unless we finally rout them. And I'm all for routing them completely in November. And I'm a Republican. God forbid.
The idea of a more authoritarian government in the United States, it has some roots that go a little deeper, I think, than just Trump and Republicans who are scared of the outcome of the vote.
It goes all the way to 1776.
Yeah. But a specific kind of opinion, which you can see showing up in business, some business press, right-wing press, certainly, but even in places like Foreign Affairs, the magazine. But essentially that the United States may need a more authoritarian government to properly compete with China. And that this idea of liberal democracy maybe has had its day. How serious a conversation is that?
It's a very serious conversation. We have had a running dialogue at William & Mary, along with several sister colleges, about this, the retreat of international liberalism, the retreat of liberal democracy. And we've even talked about the United States and used Donald Trump as the exemplar of that retreat. There are people in the lower classes, people in the middle classes, and as you intimated, people in the wealthier classes that are all for authoritarianism. But as I said, this is nothing new. Look at what Barr said about our Constitution and the Bill of Rights. Barr essentially said the Constitution was all we needed. That's Jimmy Madison. That's most of the people at the Constitutional Convention. That's the people who thought a landed, white, wealthy elite ought to run the new government that they were creating. Along came the Anti-Federalists and Patrick Henry and said, on my deathbed, will you do that? And I certainly will not bring Virginia into your Constitution. And the reason Patrick Henry and the Anti-Federalists did that was because they said, look, this is what we fought for. These 10 amendments do things like keep soldiers out of your home. They give you the right to a trial. They give you the right to peaceful assembly. These are the things we fought the revolution for, Jimmy boy. You either include these in your Constitution or Virginia ain't voting for it. And to Madison's credit, I don't know whether it was political expediency or whether the Anti-Federalists convinced him of the wisdom of their ways, but he became an advocate for the Bill of Rights. And then the Bill of Rights, of course, was included. For Barr to go back to those days and reopen that argument, for me, Barr needs to be gone as badly as Trump needs to be gone.
That was retired Colonel Lawrence Wilkinson in conversation with Paul Jay on his podcast, The Analysis. This is Pacifica Radio's COVID Race and Democracy. Stay with us. Ain't Nobody Going to Turn Me Around by Latasha Brown, featuring the McRae Sisters from Songs of the Souls of Black Folks. This is COVID Race and Democracy. I'm Akua Holt. Workers around the country are taking this election seriously. In Philadelphia, IBT 623 Secretary Treasurer Richard Hooker, who represents UPS workers, talked to Pacifica about the election issues his members have.
The biggest issue for our members as it pertains to this upcoming election with the United States president, we just want to make sure that we elect a president who is pro-labor, you know, who doesn't want to, you know, give company-friendly appointees to the NLRB, and we want to make sure that we elect a person who will strengthen labor, progress labor, and make sure that we can continue to take care of our families, not only now, but in the future. As you well know, the current occupant of the White House has weakened labor and appointed, you know, company-friendly people to the NLRB and making it harder for our stewards to do their job. And when you have companies who just dominate the work, which they all do, you want to make sure that you have friends in high places that's going to help you continue to strengthen labor laws and strengthen the working class, because, you know, without the working class, then there is no America. And so we need to make sure that we continue to keep putting pressure on labor laws and people who are in the legislative bodies who control those laws.
And we're speaking to Richard Hooker. He's Secretary-Treasurer of Teamsters Local 623. Now, Richard, you were recently elected as part of an upsurge in your local, and you had a campaign, 623 Lives Matter. What was that all about, your campaign in the union for rank-and-file control in your local?
A lot has changed since I started working for UPS and becoming a 63 Teamster. When I first started, it was a lot of, you know, older members and Caucasian members, but now that has changed dramatically. Now there's more young members, a lot of Generation X and Generation Z. A lot of the older members have now retired. So now we have this new group who, this is their first union job. Some of them don't even know what a union is. And so what we wanted to do was appeal to those younger workers, because, you know, in the next 10, 15 years, these members will now be the senior members. So we need to engage with them. And so what we did was we tried to use everything that's going on in the country as far as the Lives Matter movement that you see. And by myself being African-American and, you know, being the first African-American person to lead this 100-year local, we knew that race was going to be an issue. So instead of just dancing around the problem of race and dealing with it, we just hit it head on. Hey, listen, 623 Lives Matter. I understand that it has some, you know, some connotations with the Black Lives Matter movement, but the 623 Lives Matter movement was based on the members of 623, their families, the future of 623. The future of 623 Lives, they matter. The current 623 Lives Matter. And so what we did, we just built around that movement, and we just stayed at it. We stayed active. We were visible. We changed the bylaws to make it more transparent of the things that go on in our local, so there won't be no second guessing or questions about what the leadership is doing, whether it be finances or contracts or political aspirations or whatever the case may be. We just used that moniker to grab the attention of the younger members and to let the older, more seasoned seniority members understand that, hey, listen, we understand that this is something new with the race thing, but we can either stand on the sideline and keep letting the company dominate us and letting the leaders just take our money and not doing the work, or we can just say, hey, okay, Hooker, I understand that you're African-American. This is the first time this ever happened in this local, but we're going to stand behind your message, your vision, along with your team, and we're going to give you guys a chance. And that's what happened.
And when you say 623 Lives Matter, is that connected as well to the situation of UPS workers as far as COVID and protecting health and safety on the job?
Absolutely, absolutely. And what happened as everywhere in this country, COVID hit and no one had a plan because this was brand new. But we held the company to the fire. I mean, we were on local news, national news, talking about how UPS did not, you know, respect the workers and how they just left us out in there to die. You know, they talk about essential, but what they proved was at that time that we were just disposable. As long as we kept the packages moving and kept delivering the packages and risking our lives, as long as the lives of our families, they didn't care. So what we had to do was we had a campaign where we filed safety grievances in our collective bargaining agreement. We also, you know, we sent them videos of bathrooms that didn't have running water. We sent them how the facilities were trashed, the trash everywhere, which, you know, one of the things that CDC and everybody was saying, that you need to have a clean area, you need to be 6 feet apart, you need to have glass and gloves and all these things. And at the time, UPS refused to provide us these things, no matter how much we filed those grievances. They didn't care. So what we did was we put them on blast. We had their feet to the fire. We told NBC. We've been on social media, with social media outlets, with social media news. And we constantly just told them, hey, we're not going anywhere. We're keeping this country running as well as this company. And they need to do the right thing by our members, because it's not just the members putting their life on the line. They're also are putting their family lives, because they're out here in this COVID environment delivering these packages to people who they don't know who may have it, and then they're taking it back home. So when the company does not respect that, then it's up to us to make sure that they do the right thing by not only the member, but also the member's family.
And some unions, the Rochester Labor Council in New York and others, Madison, Seattle, Martin Luther King Labor Council, have said that if Trump ignores the result of the election, there needs to be a national general strike. What are your thoughts about Trump if he does say he's going to disregard the results of the election?
Well, you know what? I've been asked this question a lot, and I'm all for a general strike. But I think what needs to happen is the leadership needs to get involved with the members and let our members know what that looks like. Because we have to plan for that. We have to engage our membership to let them know, hey, listen, if Trump decides he's going to disregard the outcome, if he loses, that he's going to hold the company hostage, then this is what labor, our reaction, this is our responsibility, and this is how we're going to take action. You can't go on strike without a plan, because it'll be chaos. And, you know, you'll never win a strike in chaos.
That was Richard Hooker, Philadelphia IBT 623 Secretary Treasurer, speaking to Steve Zeltzer. The California Proposition 22, heavily funded by Uber, Lyft, and other app companies, seeks to classify drivers as independent contractors as opposed to workers with rights under current labor laws. Opponents to Proposition 22 recently rallied to talk about the app industry and the lives of gig workers. Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer takes it from here.
This is Steve Zeltzer with Pacifica. In California, Proposition 22 is on the ballot. It has been funded with over $218 million by Uber, Lyft, and other app companies. This is the most costly ballot initiative in the history of the United States, and last week a rally was held at the mansion of Uber CEO Dara Khosrowshahi in Pacific Heights. Their ballot proposition, written by corporate lawyers, would prevent drivers from receiving workers' compensation, disability, unemployment, and Social Security. It could also lead to the destruction of all full-time jobs and for all workers to be put on an app with no protection or stability on their jobs. Speakers at the rally talked about this platform and what it means to working people. Author Steve Hill, who wrote Raw Deal, How the Uber Economy and Runaway Capitalism Are Screwing American Workers, spoke. Now to the rally.
Look what's happened to traffic congestion before COVID pandemic. The city was flooded with cars from Uber and Lyft. There's about 1,800 traditional taxi cars in San Francisco. There's over 9,000 Uber and Lyft cars on at any one time. So 5 to 1, and you see that in city after city. Their business model is to flood your streets with cars.
They are running ads that are saying, you want to stay an independent contractor, vote yes on Proposition 22. That is a lie, people. Because a real independent contractor, which most veteran drivers like myself want to be, real independent contractors, a real independent contractor sets their own rates, terms, and conditions. And it's not with the control mechanisms. Basically, the drivers, the workers for Uber, Lyft, DoorDash, Postmates, Instacart are called independent contractors, but they are treated worse than part-time minimum wage employees. Those folks actually have more rights and protections, and in some cases benefits, than we do. It's entirely unacceptable when these gig corporations that are multi-billionaire, multinational corporations are violating labor laws that were established more than 100 years ago. You're talking about the Fair Labor Standards Act, 1938, It states what a real independent contractor is. It talks about misclassification of workers. The hiring entity has a choice to establish their business model based on the type of workers that they are using. If they want the workers to be independent contractors, real ones, not the fake news ones that folks like Dara, the Uber CEO, and the other companies here are doing, where they call them independent contractors and treat them poorly. No, real independent contractors that set their own rates, terms, and conditions. That's what it is legally.
This is Steve Zeltzer with Pacifica.
Fahima Sek talks to Pukim Nere of the National Association of Kawaita Organizations about Black Solidarity Day 2020. The day was conceived 50 years ago by the late Dr. Carlos Russell. It occurs the day before Election Day. Black Solidarity 2020 will be the day prior to one of the most significant yet contentious elections of the 21st century.
Black Solidarity Day is a celebration, the unification of the Black community in goals to be achieved, such as police violence, the economy, presently the treatment of the COVID-19 response. Black Solidarity Day began with the founder, Carlos Russell. Carlos Russell, he saw a play by Douglas Turner Ward, and that play was called The Day of Absence in the late 60s. And it was about if the Black community did not show up in a particular small Southern town. The response was that people were affected by people not showing up to work, no school, and no shopping. So the economy was affected by people not shopping, people not showing up to work, or the production line, and no school. And people decided to teach their own children for that day, or their own history. He adapted that from the A Day of Absence. In the 1971, approximately, the Solidarity Day became a form of action, in which there was no work. People didn't go to work. People did not shop unless it was within the Black community or Black ownership. And there was no, children attended teach-ins. And so that idea has been going on for basically almost 50 years now. The emphasis was to make sure that people understand that we get nowhere unless we have a unity in the community. That's not going to be 100%, but at least getting over that 50-yard line, understanding the ideas that are complexities to all of us.
Now, I know when I was coming of age in Harlem, Black Solidarity Day meant no school, no work, no shopping, unless, of course, we were recycling Black dollars. And we more or less would attend a symposium or conference sponsored by Alambe Brat at the Harriet Tubman School. What's Black Solidarity Day 2020 going to look like?
For the celebration of the day of Black Solidarity Day, there'll be a march. Here in Brooklyn, we'll be marching down Fulton Street, which is the main in the Bedford-Stuyvesant area. From 7 to 9, there'll be a virtual rally that people can go online and see, and there'll be different people making different presentations to acknowledge the importance of that day, as well as the work of Carlos Russell.
How will other people around the country be able to get involved?
If they want information, they can call 718-398-1766. That's 718-398-1766. Or they can email nacoinfogroup@yahoo.com.
I'm Fahima Sek, and my guest today has been Pukim Nere from the National Association of Kawaita Organization, and this is COVID, Race, and Democracy.
Bird leaps on the back of the wind and floats downstream till the currents heat and dips his wing in the orange sun rays and dares to claim the sky. bird that stalks down his narrow cage can seldom see through his bars of rage.
That was Buckshot LaFunk, featuring Dr. Maya Angelou. This is COVID Race and Democracy. I'm Akua Holt. From the beginning, the founders of this nation were duplicitous. The role of slavery in building the United States has been hidden. Between 1815 and 1865, over a million African children were stolen and sold or traded within the United States. The founders worked hard to erase the economic significance of slavery to give the impression of their greatest and highest ideals. Dr. Masha Adebayo of What's at Stake spoke with Dr. Ed Baptist of Cornell University regarding his latest book, The Half Has Never Been Told, Slavery and the Making of American Capitalism. Here's Dr. Baptist.
You know, the United States comes into being as a country whose leaders make certain claims about their relationship to ideals of freedom, liberty, and natural rights. And from the beginning of the nation's existence, critics from outside and inside the nation are pointing to slavery, which was, of course, a widespread institution in the European colonization of the New World, the enslavement of African people and also of Native indigenous people as well. People point to this institution as a profound contradiction, as something that renders the claims of the new nation to a special status, to a reason for existence, reason for their rebellion from the against the British Crown, as something so profoundly hypocritical that it can even call into question the ideals of liberty itself. And so just from the point of view of establishing a justification for the country, over time, the significance of slavery to that country's political, economic, and other kinds of strength, they've got to be reduced in importance and in significance. They've got to be papered over. They've got to ultimately be erased. Of course, that's in tension with the very profound desire of slave owners to make a claim to a special role in leading that country. So all kinds of deals get cut to enable those slaveholders to protect the institution of slavery. And at the same time, that's baked right into the Constitution with things like the Fugitive Slave Clause, the Three-Fifths Compromise, some implicit and at times pretty explicit acknowledgments of the so-called right of enslavers to hold human beings as property, to on the one hand erase this, and on the other hand to support and provide for the continuation and even expansion of that institution. They're critics right from the beginning, and none of them more consistent or courageous than enslaved African people themselves.
Mm-hmm. How do we connect this erasure of history to what we're seeing in the streets right now, mm-hmm. in terms of the extrajudicial killings of African Americans?
Yeah, I think that in particular, if you're talking about activism against racialized policing, which of course has been a really profound and driving force of activism over the last decade, but it goes back well beyond that. It goes back to the act of running away from slavery, right? Which is a profound and courageous form of resistance to that attempt to control what African and African descendant people can do, where they can go, where they have to stay, et cetera. I have to say that, you know, there's always been more than an asterisk. It's always been a foundational assumption of white identity in this country. In fact, you could even, if you want to be really provocative, argue that it is the foundational assumption of white identity in this country, that that Black people have to be policed in a different way from white people, and that all white people have a share in that task. It is a constitutive task of whiteness, of white political and social identity, to control, if not directly control, at least to vicariously give assent to institutions, that ensure that Black people are properly submissive, that they properly follow the rules about when and where they can go. And when that gets challenged, as it has been repeatedly throughout the history of the U.S., even before the history of the U.S., whether by Black people alone or whether by Black people in cooperation with Indigenous and white and other allies and accomplices, what we tend to see is that crisis is what comes out of that. We saw that in the lead up to the Civil War. We saw that beginning really with the Great Migration to the North, but sort of peaking in the 1960s, and we're seeing it again today. Mm-hmm.
So Thomas Jefferson realized early on that more births by enslaved women meant more profit for him. And he said, "I consider a woman who brings a child every 2 years as more profitable than the best man on the farm. What she produces is an addition to the capital." And at one point, Jefferson brags to George Washington that the birth of Black children was increasing Virginia's capital stock by 4% annually. So during the expansion of cotton plantations, the deliberate breeding or raping of African women became an industry. Dr. Baptist, how important was the breeding or the raping corporate industry to the growth of the early American economy? And what kind of psychological dominance did that impose over Black bodies as private property?
Yeah, that's a question with a lot of layers. And if I say to you, slave breeding, quote unquote, was a key part of the U.S. economy, there'll be plenty of historians who jump up and say, well, we have no documented evidence, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Thing is, we do have a lot of we have a lot of documented evidence of rape. We have a lot of documented evidence that white enslavers were selling the children, their own children in some cases, right, into the domestic slave trade. And more broadly, the children of women whose children were sellable, right, by U.S. law, which made every childbirth in certain ways the product of a kind of sexual violence, right, no matter who the father was or how the act of conception had taken place, right? A kind of sexual violence inflicted by white people on Black people in the United States. And likewise, people might say, well, that's, you know, part of the law of slavery, right? The so-called enslaved womb concept, which is in use in the colonies, the Spanish ones, the Portuguese ones, French ones and the English ones by the 1500s and certainly by the 1600s in the English ones. That concept didn't get invented by Thomas Jefferson, right? But he knew how to take advantage of it. And what we see in that I think is, you know, beyond the things that people are going to say to submerge what actually happened, right? Which is that millions and millions of women gave birth to children who were stolen from them at birth, right? Even if they were living in the same place, right? Living in the same house. They were in some crucial ways stolen property from birth. Perhaps more than any other country, the United States takes advantage of that that construct of Western law.
That was Dr. Ed Baptist speaking to Marsha Adebayo of What's at Stake. Special thanks to producer Lona Elias. George Floyd's longtime friends are founders of 88 Chomp, a new nonprofit dedicated to honoring his legacy by advocating for families and individuals. George Floyd was killed by former police officer Derek Chauvin, who posted a $1 million bail and was released from custody in October 2020. He was allowed to leave the state while he awaits trial, according to a new bail conditions outlined in court records. And now we hear from two of the co-founders of 88 Chomp, Herbert Mouton and Jonathan Ville.
We want to carry on Floyd's legacy see, number one, in a positive manner. Number two, we don't want this to happen to anyone, no matter what nationality or race they are. We need to encourage those people. Number one, voting is very important. Number two, not only do we have to pay attention to the voting at the presidential level, but we also have to pay more attention to the voting at the local level. The immediate effect that it have on our community. Going into the law enforcement, we need to understand as citizens, what do law enforcement expect from us? And we need to let the law enforcement know what we expect from them. We need to be more knowledgeable of policies, procedures, and laws. So those are two of our main initiatives. We also want to bring in the neighbor back in the hood. The Inverell Trade Center that's on Sampson that's been closed down for over 30 years. That was basically a daycare and an after-school center for our kids in the neighborhood. Where do our kids have to go after school? We're trying to bring those things back in.
Brother Jonathan.
I would echo a lot of what Herbert said. I really think about how we kind of started coming together. As I was traveling back to Oklahoma City from Houston after the funeral, I just still had this void in my mind and my heart, not having a level of closure. It wasn't until, you know, I reached out to Herbert and then Vaughn and Gerald that they were feeling the same way. And it was like, okay, guys, we can't just continue to talk about the problem, but we got to be a part of the solution. We have many initiatives. These two are so germane right now to the climate of where our society is. Not only people registered, but educating them as well on who to vote for, how to ask the proper questions to those who are running for a specific position, and then also getting to the polls. It's not just getting up to register, it's not just enough getting up to be educated about the perspective candidates, but you have to vote. You have to exercise your right. So many people over the years, my forefathers, aunties, our uncles, our grandparents, former civic and community leaders, they sacrificed so much in order that we may have the right to exercise our voice by voting. We want to do all we can to not only get out there and get people registered and marketed, but just continue to let people know that they can vote. They can have their voice be heard in a strong and powerful way.
What do you say to people out there comment about, we've been voting since the Voting Rights Bill was passed, and we don't see change fast enough?
When you think about the systems that are in place, and you think about systemic racism and biases, they didn't happen overnight. It won't be overnight for us to get out of that. I've been using the phrase when people ask that question, that we have to understand that this is not a sprint, but it's a marathon. What the system is designed to do is to wait us out. It's designed for us to have emotional fatigue. We have to understand, even though I talked about getting registered to vote and educate them and then voting, you also, when those elected officials are in office, hold them accountable for the things that they said on their platform while they were running. And if they don't live up to those things, you exercise your right once again to vote them out. That's how I would answer that.
And just to kind of piggyback on Jonathan just said, it's about following up, holding them accountable. They're not accountable the same way we voted them in. We vote them out.
The organization 88 Chump combines the jersey number worn by the late George Floyd, who played football with his teammates at Jack Gates High School in the heart of Third Ward, Houston. It's an acronym that stands for Communities Helping Underprivileged Minorities Progress.
To stand up for your rights, yeah.
Get up, stand up,
yeah, yeah.
Stand up for your rights. Get up, stand up,
get up, stand up.
Don't give up the fight.
Life is your right.
Get up, stand up.
So we can't give up the fight.
This concludes this week's edition of COVID Race and Democracy. We thank all Pacifica stations and affiliates who contribute to this production. You can find this and all previous episodes on our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. This show was produced by myself, Akua Holt, Paulina Vasiliev. Our executive producers are Steve Zeltzer, Paulina Vasiliev, and me, Akua Holt. Also your host. Thanks for listening. Special thanks to producers Lorna Alliance, Ann Garrison, and Fahima Sack. I will leave you with this quote by Ida B. Wells. The way to right wrongs is to turn the light of truth upon them.